Hello, welcome to Podcast Hubungan Internasional. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of International Relations, Universitas Gajah Mada, in collaboration with Podcast Damai Pangkal Damai. I'm your host, Diah Kusumaningrum. October 2nd, which is Mahatma Gandhi's birthday, has been widely celebrated as the International Day of Nonviolence. In this double episode, we'll be talking about nonviolent resistance amidst digital repression. We are joined by Janjira Sumbatpunsiri and Alfredo Putrawijoyo. In the first part of this episode, we'll be discussing a report that Janjira co-written with Dean on digital repression in Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, and Vietnam, and juxtapose it with Alfredo's observation on digital repression in Indonesia. In the second part of this episode, we'll be looking at how various parts of the society push back against digital repression using methods of nonviolent resistance. So, Janjira, in July, the Isaias Yusuf Ishak Institute released a report, which you co-authored with Dean, on how governments in Cambodia, Myanmar, Thailand, and Vietnam politicized and weaponized fake news allegations, ultimately giving them the justification for applying repressive measures. Can you walk us through these mechanisms of politicization and weaponization?
Yeah, so definitely. Thanks again for having me. Well, let me begin with a little bit of a background of the report. I've been working on basically the data regarding how governments in Asia have enforced laws supposed to curb disinformation or so-called fake news. And the trend has intensified since the COVID pandemic, right? And so we thought, like, usually these laws are used to charge government critics. But then we realized that the justification related to curbing this information has expanded from its use in terms of charging critics to other tactics of suppressing digital space. So, and that's why we kind of look into four existing digital repression tactics, which are, internet shutdowns, content filtering, social media monitoring, basically digital surveillance and legal prosecution, right? And so when we discuss mechanisms of this pattern, we look into a two-prong process, if you like. So one is politicization and the other is weaponization. So politicization has to do with how the term fake news, or sometimes disinformation and other times false information, is defined vaguely in the laws regarding fake news and, across government speeches about using this allegation, right? And so politicization is about definition, how the definition is politicized. And for example, the process is like this. Usually, the government wouldn't say what exactly constitute the notion of fake news, but then what they highlight is the consequence of fake news, right? These are usually horrible consequences: national insecurity, electoral undermining, and anti-state in the case of Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So you have these two components of politicization: one is vagueness of fake news, and the other is horrible consequence. And the second is weaponization. This is about action. Right, so you have the politics of definition, and then you have ways in which governments abuse these laws and the term fake news to basically penalize and to undergird a variation of practices of digital repression. And so weaponization is about what governments do in terms of justifying its repressive practices under the banner of fake news.
Mm-hmm. Justifying methods that in normal conditions would easily be identified as repressive. But since, you know, the consequences of this alleged fake news is so dire, it's quote unquote justified and okay to use it. Well, all four countries that you covered in your research are autocracies, at least by Freedom House and Varieties of Democracies indices. And while all these four Southeast Asia autocracies politicized and weaponized fake news, there seems to be a variation in terms of the methods that they used. So if I'm not mistaken, all four of them applied legal prosecution, only three applied block and takedown methods, two applied digital surveillance, and one applied internet shutdown. What explains this variation, or would you care to elaborate on this variation?
Yeah, I mean, I have to sort of state some disclaimer. These are the trends that we notice. The research is not quantitatively conducted in any sense. So it's our observation that when we go through news archives, what we see is how governments use the claim of anti-fake news to kind of justify different practices. And what we see quite common across four countries is the use of a fake news claim to charge government critiques, right? So when you say something contradicting to what government said, then you are accused of spreading fake news, yeah? And therefore there's legal consequence. So that's common across the board. And I think that's also common in Indonesia as well, right? But then the other three trends are emerging, and I think that's why I said that we started to notice the expansive use of anti-fake news justification. And we found that in Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia, governments use such an allegation, such a claim, when they want to justify content filtering or content censorship, right? And then in Thailand and Vietnam, a common trend, an additional common trend, is how cracking down on fake news would justify digital repression, meaning that state agencies have to now monitor social media feeds 24/7 in order to detect fake news, right? So the legal charges, legal repression, often accompanies surveillance. Yeah, you can only know who did something wrong when you monitor someone. And then last but not least, Myanmar is very unique. It's the only country that has severe internet shutdowns. I mean, of course, Cambodia has that from time to time, but it's not as extensive and severe as Myanmar because of the political backdrop in Myanmar. And so what explains this variation? I mean, again, I have to state disclaimer, we haven't done the research systematically for this, but I think from our like initial hunch is that, first of all, we think that the degree in which countries rely on digital space for their economy is very important, right? Countries like, and we're talking about middle-income country like Thailand and Vietnam, that rely on digital economy so much. And so shutting the internet would be unthinkable. And I would say the same thing for Indonesia, for the Philippines, right? So it would be unthinkable. And then you have Myanmar, whose digital economy is emerging, but it's not as extensive as in Thailand and Vietnam, right? And in the middle of this is Cambodia, yeah, where the government just turn to a national internet gateway, which is something akin to China's firewall, internet firewall. And so that means that all the incoming content, right, online content, would have to go through one channel, which would jam that channel at some point if your economy is so huge, right, and digitally dependent. And so I think that the reliance on digital economy is one factor. And so I think the second factor, possible factor, is existing state capacities when it comes to repression, right? And so, I mean, Thailand and Vietnam don't have to rely on such a costly repressive tool like internet shutdown. Because they can do other things. They can harass activists very subtly, and we'll come back to this point. They can monitor, and they can actually impose self-discipline among the population in to some extent, I think, and in a more extensive degree in Vietnam. And so in that sense, when it comes to repression, really we talk about cost. Right, repression is about raising cost for challenger of the status quo, but also the oppressor, the repressor, also have the price to pay, and so they have to calculate. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, always rational calculation, but according to their own perception, right, what costs them in terms of what. Right. And therefore they go for specific options because the cost after the calculation for them is not as high, but for the challengers is high.
Okay. So one is how important digital economy is for that country, and another one is state capacity. I still have a lot of questions for you, Janjira, but at this moment, I'll move on to Alfredo first. Well, Indonesia, by Freedom House, also Varieties of Democracy and other indices of democracy, still fare better than the four aforementioned countries. However, I have the feeling that, you know, the various methods of digital repression that Janjira elaborated, we already feel it, we already experience it here. Do you care to elaborate more on that and share your observation?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that notion. You know, to my experience on reading, researching, and doing some a bit delving into the background and some data collection on what kinds of digital repression methods that Indonesian government uses, these four methods are in use. But before that, I think we can say some things first about these democracy ratings. I think they're a fair ground for introducing us to certain countries and their situations. And Indonesia's country rating for from Varieties of Democracy, sure, it's on electoral democracies, and on Freedom House, it's partly free. But when we take a look at, you know, these digital repression methods, and they're mostly doing so via unlawful conduct or through an unfair rule of law. And when we take a look at the specific details on the evaluation of the rule of law, perhaps based on the Freedom House rating, it's quite poor. You know, rating it out of four, Indonesia is one, based on, like, discrepancies and variations, and very much, you know, there is no due process, and there's rampant, you know, unlawful usage of police violence, etc. And extant literature has been saying that Indonesia is overseeing a democratic backsliding ever since the mid-2010s. Some scholars wouldn't go as far as to say that Indonesia is undergoing some sort of democratic reversal. But I think most accurately, I think most precisely, right now, Marcus Metzner puts it that Indonesia is seeing variations of authoritarian innovations. Sure, Indonesia is not undergoing a very distinct and very brutal or very immense form of reversal, but we see some sort of methods that are used by the Indonesian government in terms of quelling opposition. And it's used by the very diverse elites. It's used by very diverse actors that is being supported by the status quo. And one of these innovations that was identified is particularly and specifically the usage or labeling of fake news to quell these oppositions. The four methods that was aforementioned is also engaged in Indonesia. And I think Mas Damar Juniato from SafeNet has also introduced us to several other tactics that is used by the Indonesian government and the police in particular. First one is labeling some news as fake itself. You know, the Indonesian government and the Ministry of Communication and Information often does this, sharing it on their social media accounts or on their website, putting a stamp on a screenshot. You know, this is a hoax and that sort of method. Prosecuting civilians, legal prosecution is also rampant. There is internet shutdown, and not only shutdown, but also like throttling. You know, not necessarily like shutting down the internet completely. And there's slowing it down. And there's variations across space. You know, where is it? Where are these mass protests are happening? And they also implant false evidence. So I think that's really interesting. Seeing that it's using the repressive methods of in justification of fighting fake news, but they're also, you know, planting these false evidences. And again, they also pressure platforms, they also monitor and survey social media accounts, social media platforms as a whole, the internet, several websites, and they pressure these companies to take down these posts, or, you know, pressure if they're not going to do and if they're not going to take down these posts, they're also going to ban or block the website. And of course, you know, repressive, like punitive, actual violent police force. Several regulations are used for these digital repressions. The first one is the quite famous and controversial, the Electronic Information and Transaction Bill, or UITE, and also the Criminal Code, the 1946 Bill on Incitement to Disorder or Riot. And, you know, there's also various government regulations, executive decrees and ministerial regulations. And similar to what the regulations are in Cambodia, in Myanmar, in Thailand, and Vietnam, Indonesia also does not precisely define what fake news is. You know, in a previous research, me and my colleagues at the Center for Digital Society here at Psikologi.KM also finds that, you know, even private companies, private social media companies that also must you know, moderate their accounts, they lambast, they publish a white paper that is saying, oh, Indonesia's regulation on what is defined as fake news or negative content in general, like content that is prohibited, is very vague and it's very prone for, you know, weaponization and politicization yet again. Some high profile examples, you know, internet shutdown, for example. In August 2019, there was a mass uprest due to some racist remarks that was purported towards a university student from Papua that was studying in Surabaya. And there was massive outrest at the provinces of West Papua and Papua. And in response, the Indonesian government shut down the internet for, I think, a few days in Papua. And in May of 2019, and I think also in the months in 2020, when there was mass uprest against the government's few decisions in May of 2019, it was against the Election Commission. And in 2020, it was against the Omnibus Bill. The internet was throttled. Sure, it's not shutting down the internet completely, but it was slowed down. You know, communication is basically grinded to a halt. Some activists, some organizers are unable to communicate to each other, so it's making it very difficult for on-ground activists to, you know, do their stuff. And since 2013, year on year, at least 20 people are legally prosecuted using UITE. A majority of them, uses defamation. Sure, it's not fake news, but defamation and fake news are often used hand in hand here in Indonesia. And I think the variety of actors also puts a play here. Most of them are government officials that sued these people that are legally prosecuting them, but also sometimes private businesses, like private actors, are also using this, and particularly those that have very close connection with government officials as well. So it's quite intertwined between the both of them. And there's also a belief that the government is attempting to better their technical capacities to monitor and filter social media and the internet. Millions of Indonesian rupiah are funneled into research for a scraping machine that's going to, you know, scour the internet for some keywords, some information, some social media content for them to take down, report, or legally prosecute, etc. And you know, its latest manifestation is the minister regulation that, you know, forces electronic systems operators to register with Kominfo and, you know, give all the data. And lastly, I think the notion that these forms of repression are a part of the citizens' our daily life here in Indonesia, you know, this was some highlight, and it can be reflected in, you can see it, you can see it, you can feel it, you can read it in the daily interactions of social media users in Twitter, in Instagram, in Facebook. You know, people use it as a joke. If there's some contents that hints at critiquing the government, you know, people will say, oh, watch out, there's going to be tukang bakso. Tukang bakso is the street vendor that sells meatballs. The joke is they usually are intelligence divisions from the police, like their FBI and their CIA. They go undercover as street vendors. You know, it creates a chilling effect. There's some massive grounds to believe that there's self-censorship going on, and it impacts like the daily conversation. And there's also the Indonesian Cyber Police. It's a relatively new division in Indonesia. They're supposedly is used, you know, to fight like online criminal activities like scams and that sort of stuff. But as of now, most of their activities, sure, they're doing some stuff in, you know, prosecuting like scams and all that stuff, but their most dangerous activities are going around identifying some social media contents that are dissenting opinions against the government, and they're threatening to take these social media posts down. You know, some warnings, you know, for these accounts from the cyber police, and if not taken down within 24 hours, the account is threatened to be taken down. Most people joke about the Indonesian cyber police or cyber crime unit, because most of the time they're portrayed as incompetent, I guess, sort of. Even their website is suffered a DDoS attack, you know, a few months ago, if I'm not mistaken, and the website, you know, frequently went down. I went to visit the website a couple of times, and it went down. The graphic design isn't very good. I think it's not as robust as it should be for cybercrime unit, which is, I think it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing if we take a look at it, and so that we can, you know, circumvent them. It's a bad thing to realize how they're the ones that are going to be protecting our personal data, protecting our personal data, that sort of stuff. So it's a bit of an emerging discourse that are surrounding the cyber police, what is to do with them, and with more and more online activities going around in Indonesia, their Indonesian cyber police is going to be more and more salient in the near future.
Janjira and Alfredo, thank you for sharing with us the state of digital repression that we are in now in Southeast Asia. We'll talk more with you in the second part of this episode on how various parts of civil society push back against this digital repression. So stay tuned.